Now, reaction chains. Reaction chains are related to. Reaction chains are related to modal action patterns. They are initiated by a particular stimulus, or at least parts of the chain are initiated by particular stimuli, let's say. Progression through the sequence of behaviors is condition dependent. So in the case of a reaction chain, the subject will start with whatever the most appropriate behavior in the chain is, and can terminate the sequence of behaviors at the most appropriate place as well. So, I mean, just visually here, you've got a stimulus that initiates an action or behavior, and that leads to an outcome. That outcome, something that in the environment has changed in some way. The outcome then is, in essence, a new stimulus. So in this way, we can have stimulus one. You know, if you start, you know, here's our chain. Okay, here's our actual chain of stimulus, action, stimulus, action, stimulus, action, and so on. If you happen to encounter stimulus one, if that's what you're presented with, okay, good enough. That causes you to perform action one. This action then brings you in contact somehow or changes the environment to produce stimulus 2, which then causes you to perform action 2, which ideally produces stimulus 3, change in the environment somehow, etc. Now, if instead, you know, you are presented with stimulus 3, somehow, I don't know, if there's a reaction chain in terms of cracking open a nut so that you can, you know, crack open the get the nut from the tree, crack the nut open, pick out the meat of the nut that you're going to eat, and then eat it. Okay, if the nut's already been brought down from the tree, if it's already been cracked open, you know, so you've stimulus three, you've got a cracked open nut sitting there already, then why not start right there? It's like, oh, all I have to do is dig out the tasty bits of the nut to eat. There's the action. I've got the little tasty bits of the nut in my paw. I'm thinking that maybe I'm a squirrel or something, you know, whatever. Eat it. Okay? If, I don't know, some, you know, nasty ethologist has taken and instead coated a bunch of nuts in a tree with epoxy resin so they can't be broken open, right? So you see the tree, nuts in the tree, you ascend the tree to get the nut, you come down, find a rock to smash this on. So there's your action too, smash, 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 smash. But after a while, if you just cannot open this nut, you know, you never get to the nut is opened case, stop, just abandon at this point, and go on. If there were some, if this was a modal action pattern, right, you just have to keep going. It's like wang, 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 wang with the nut for a while. Now, ideally, that should have by now broken it open. Our little imaginary creature might try to start picking something out of nothing, and then might start, you know, air eating. Nothing at the end, and that would execute the entire hypothetical modal action pattern. In the case of a reaction chain, much more adaptive. You can start at the most appropriate place, stop at the most appropriate place. But this is really only, you know, a small sort of extension of a modal action pattern. This way, we can see that, again, these are very, this is a very innate series of behaviors. They're evolutionarily selected for, but they do have greater variability. In a way, you might treat every stimulus action as its own little modal action pattern, if you like. It's a way of thinking about it. I'm not suggesting that's really the way this would evolve at work, but you know, if it helps you to think about this, but then it gets put together into a longer chain, a sequence of events. Now, in many behaviors have a particular sequence by which they are organized. To do the behavior in any other way defeats the functionality of the behavior. Okay? In other words, the behaviors won't work if you try to do it in some other way. In a sense, they are non-random. Right? So, this is the case. Behaviors just aren't random events. I mean, to get organisms, animals, to behave in truly random ways, you often really have to mess with them. So, like, to get a spider to make a truly random web, you, like, tend to need to, like, you know, hit it with LSD or something. So that it just says, ooh, spinner webs all over the place. Yay, spells out Summer of Love, okay? Charlotte, you know, Charlotte gets hit with some LSD and, you know, starts spelling things for Wilbur. Behaviors to be useful, to be functional, to have purpose, follow patterns. Things that don't expend energy for no reason, and that is detrimental to organisms. So, in terms of some of the terminology, then, the ethologists early on gave two sort of terms there, appetitive behavior and consummatory behavior. Now, this is not specifically dealing with eating behaviors. What they mean here is an appetitive behavior is any of the early components in the sequence. The consummatory is what they mean by consummatory, that means completion. Okay, the behavioral sequence has been consumed at this point. We are getting to the end. So the consummatory behaviors are the end behaviors in the sequence. So this doesn't have to deal with food-related stuff, okay? But we often see it being used to describe food behaviors. So there's another little issue here with this as well. Appetitive behaviors may take on a wide variety of forms. Okay, so nut in a tree, you know, if it's way up high in the branches, you got to climb much higher. If there's no branches that are low enough down that you can grab onto, maybe you have to climb a different tree and jump over to the tree that's got the nut in it to get the nut. There may be a variety of ways that you go about executing the appetitive behavior. Once you get down to the final consummatory behaviors, the end behaviors in the chain here, in the sequence, sorry, I shouldn't say chain, but the end behaviors in whatever the sequence, behavioral sequence is, they're probably going to be much more stereotypic. Right, because there's perhaps a finite number of ways of actually, if it is dealing with something you're eating, there's a finite number of ways that you can actually chew the food and swallow it, right? So that'll be much more stereotypic. There are a finite number of ways for a turkey to actually mate, et cetera, et cetera. So we go from more of a variability, there's more variability in these appetitive behaviors, down to these more fixed behaviors. So in foraging, people who study foraging now bring this concept in. So they talk about the general search mode. So they're looking very broadly through your environment for something to eat. Focal search. You've identified a potential area where there may be a resource that you can harvest. You found the resource. You move into food handling. So you're actually processing it, collecting it, doing whatever. And then finally, there's the ingestion component. So again, it's like an inverted pyramid here, or inverted triangle. You move from the general to the specific. Okay? Maybe lots of different things you do in your general search mode, right? But it gets more and more specific as you complete the behavioral sequence. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about some of the innate systems. You know, read the textbook as well. I'm not following the textbook specifically through this here. So take a look at that too. We're going to shift now. We're going to finish this lecture up by looking at habituation and sensitization. These are the simplest forms of learning. Now remember, learning is basically enduring change, you know, the short form of this, enduring change of behavior due to experience. So in habituation here, we have a decrease in response following repeated stimulus presentation. Keep in mind, not everything that's going to cause a decrease in response is going to be due to habituation. Or conversely, not everything that's going to cause an increase in response is going to be due to sensitization. But so habituation, decrease in response following the repeated presentation of a stimulus. Sensitization, increase in response due to the repeated presentation of a stimulus. Okay, so habituation reduces behavioral output, sensitization increases it. There are some differences here. In habituation, we can talk about there's sort of two sets of habituation. It's slightly more complicated here. So habituation, we either talk about a short-term type of habituation or a long-term type of habituation. The vast majority of literature that is done, or the vast majority of studies that have been conducted on habituation, deal with short-term. The time course, then, for short-term habituation, it lasts for seconds, tens of seconds, to minutes, maybe a few hours. Okay? It tends to occur more often when stimuli are presented frequently. So if you keep getting exposed to a stimulus a lot in a relatively short order. Long-term habituation, they've also got different underlying neural mechanisms, as it turns out. Long-term habituation lasts for hours, days, or possibly even longer, months. Long-term habituation may, in essence, become, for all intents and purposes, permanent in some cases. Often, long-term habituation, you'll see this when you've got fewer stimuli presentations carried out. So you're presented the stimulus, but not as frequently, not as often. You know, maybe you hear the grandfather clock, the gonging, you know, the 12 bongs of the clock, you know, only a few times a day sort of thing. Or you know, the bonging of the clock, you're not at home all the time, so you don't always hear the clock going on. You're in and out of the house, so sometimes you're there on the hour when the clock gongs or whatnot. In that case there, because you're probably exposed to it less, you may be more likely to get into long-term habituation. And, in fact, in that case, with something like, you know, this clock, this is where this may practically, for all intents and purposes, become, once you habituate, become permanent. After living with this, you know, in this house with a clock for a few weeks, you may essentially never really notice the chiming, the gonging of that clock. Essentially become a permanent thing, which kind of defeats the purpose, you know, of having the clock chiming away. Hey, it's 10 o'clock, you need to, like, go to work or something. Yeah, sorry, I'm late for work, I just got completely habituated to my clock. Yeah, unfortunate there. Yeah. Okay, mostly we'll be talking about long-term. I'm sorry. Mostly we will not be talking about long-term. Yeah. Mostly we'll be talking about short-term habituation. Okay. Sensitization. Sensitization tends to be, well, it's only short-lived. Seconds, minutes. Okay. So I know your textbook says that short-term habituation is like seconds to minutes, but it can certainly be into hours as well here. But sensitization, I mean, it's really unusual to get sensitization that's lasting more than a few minutes here. 15 minutes sort of thing. So it really is a very short time course. There's also differences with respect to stimulus specificity. Habituation is really quite stimulus specific. There is some generalization. So if we poke a rat, okay, you know, give it a little poke or something like that, you know, it might initially be startle, nothing, okay, now you can just sort of reach out and poke the rat a little bit, it doesn't do anything. If you took a little electrical prod and went bzzz and shocked it, yeah, it's going to startle. Okay, so that's not going to generalize. So in that sense, you know, a little poke. Hey, I'm poking the rat. Yeah, with an electric prod. Still a poke. With a shock. It's like, yeah, it's not going to be habituated. It's not going to generalize in that case. If, you know, instead of poking the rat with your finger, you poke it with the eraser on the end of a pencil, odds are it's going to stay generalized or habituated. The generalization will probably cut across. Like, yeah, fingertip, you know. Soft, you know, rubber eraser on the end of the pencil. As long as you're not trying to stab the pencil through the rat or something like that, you know, it's probably going to generalize. It's going to stay habituated. Okay? The habituation is going to carry over. But if you shift modality quite a bit, you know, it's like, hey, I've got a water spritzer bottle to the rat, startle. Okay, that's quite different. Sensitization, on the other hand, is really not very stimulus specific at all. So we sensitize you to one thing. Once you're sensitized, you know, almost anything's going to set you off. You know, we make loud clapping noises, but you get a startled response. You know, if we can sensitize you with this kind of stuff, all right, then, you know, we do other things like tap you on the shoulder, but, you know, hey, get our straw from the air puff, blow on you, bleh, you know, all kinds of stuff, you know, spritz water at you, bleh, right, just gonna be sensitized. Watch horror movies at night, late, the lights off, nobody else at home, you know. You've just seen massive eviscerations, decapitations, chainsawing of whoever, you know, sort of thing. And every time, you know, the back from the dead, whatever, you know, seeks revenge because he knew what happened last summer, yada, 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 shows up on screen. It's like, ah! Then, you know, the phone rings. Blah! You know, car backfires outside. Blah! Sensitization is what makes horror films fun. Or is actually, if you will, a probe trial of your heart. Okay, so, you know, is it going to keep beating? So, it's not entirely generalized, okay? So, for example, if you use a shock to sensitize a rat, or a person for that matter, it's only going to generalize to other exteroceptive, so other things that may be, you know, like poking the body or prodding it or external stimuli. It's not likely, sensitization wouldn't likely generalize to some sort of internal bodily, you know, something about something that you've just eaten or something like that. Okay, so eating a hot chili or something, it's like, wow, I've been sensitized to the shock. Now the chili is that much hotter. No, that would be quite a different modality there. So it probably won't sensitize, the sensitization probably won't generalize that much there. Okay? Both habituation and sensitization show spontaneous recovery. In some cases, this is a very unfortunate. Remember I mentioned how, you know, we've changed the modal, you know, went from fixed to modal action patterns because, well, they're not completely fixed. This is one of these examples of poor use of terminology. Spontaneous recovery in habituation and sensitization means something different than spontaneous recovery in classical conditioning. So it's a little bit unfortunate. In habituation and sensitization speak, when we talk about spontaneous recovery, what we mean is after we've gone through a habituation or sensitization process, we get a gradual return to the original level of responding. And it's just due to the passage of time. Okay. In classical conditioning, spontaneous recovery, and we'll talk about this probably later, but in classical conditioning, spontaneous recovery is after extinction, there is a passage of time and we get a return of the conditioned response. They're not exactly the same because in the case of habituation and sensitization, you're reverting to a baseline, you know, preconditioning phase. In the case of classical conditioning, you're reverting to an earlier post-conditioning phase, something post-learning. You're not returning to a state before you did any classical conditioning. So they both involve passage of time, but they have subtly different meanings, so that's a little bit unfortunate there. So spontaneous recovery, just after you've gone through the habituation sensitization, time passes and it wears off. Sensitization wears off more rapidly than habituation, typically, but they both wear off. Dishabituation occurs by exposing a subject to an extraneous novel stimulus. So we go through habituation, okay? The subject has been habituated. It no longer makes this response. You could wait for a spontaneous recovery. So you could wait for the habituation just to wear off. Or to get a return to the original response. So if we have, say, habituated a startle response, so now the rat, you know, we make a loud noise, the rat no longer startles, it's been habituated. If we expose it to a novel stimulus, an extraneous stimulus, so like squirted in the face with a missed bottle of water, you know, from misting plants, go, you know, little poof of water in the face, it's going to go back to doing its startle response. We have dishabituated it. Essentially what happens here is this novel stimulus, this extraneous new stimulus, sensitizes our critter, sensitizes our subject. And the sensitization, right, if sensitization is increasing the behavior response, habituation is decreasing it, they're really in opposition. They cancel out. If you've read ahead in the text, there's an opponent process theory of habituation that we'll talk about in a little bit. Also the dual process theory of habituation. So essentially what we're doing is the dishabituation is essentially sensitizing the organism. So they work in this opposite manner. Okay, so if you've got to get the pre-habituation behavior back quickly, for whatever reason, or just because it's, you know, empirically fun to try this, try dishabituation. Otherwise, you just kind of sit and wait, wait for it to wear off through spontaneous recovery. Now, I mentioned that not everything that causes... Oh, I'm sorry, yep. Yes. Yeah, will he now startle to the loud noise as well? Yeah. Maybe not fully, but it's going to remove a good chunk of that habituation process there. Yeah. Yeah, good question. Remember I said that not everything that causes, you know, a reduction in behavior is necessarily going to be habituation? So sensory adaptation. This is just a temporary change in the neural response to a stimulus as a result of being presented with the stimulus. So, you know, not noticing that you're wearing a bracelet or a watch band after a while, okay? Not noticing the wearing a wedding. No, no, I always remember the wedding ring because the awesome responsibility I have with my family. Anyways, yeah, so you know, sensory adaptation. Your nerves, your sensory nerves just go, yeah, we're not firing anymore. We're doing a lot of that. Still here. Time to stop firing. Okay. Sensory adaptation is not response specific. So the way you could test, do you have habituation or do you have sensory adaptation, is you can test on a specific, a particular response there. So habituation is going to be much more response specific there. Response fatigue, on the other hand, this is due to either neurons or muscle fibers no longer functioning optimally or in some cases at all because they're basically just exhausted. You've worked them to their maximal or close to maximal capacity, and you know their ADB, their energy sources are exhausted, or neurotransmitters have all been used up, or whatever. In this case here, the test is habituation is going to be stimulus specific, whereas response fatigue is not. So. Again, we can distinguish there. Okay. So not everything that causes behaviors to decrease. And I mean, you know, for most cases, that's not really a big issue. But, you know, if you were doing an empirical study, you'd want to make sure that you weren't getting confounds in your study somehow. Okay. So physiologically or neurophysiologically, how does habituation actually work? It's actually very simple, I mean, relatively speaking. Here. So in terms of the underlying neurological components here, it's not that complicated. Interestingly as well, it seems, I mean, at least as far as we can tell, the same principles, neurophysiological principles of habituation act across species. This has been very nice from a neurophysiological perspective or neuropsychology perspective because it means that we can use things like aplysia, sea slug, as a lovely non-human animal model for understanding and learning about learning about the habituation processes. So with our sea slug, aplysia, it's basically a snail without a shell. So its gill is on its back. Its gill is basically like its lung. It breathes through its gill. So it's hanging out there in the water. If you were to poke at the Ecclesia's gill, it would get damaged. It's like if you were walking around carrying your lungs with you and someone walked up and said, "Hey, look at those lungs." It's like, "Ah, don't poke my lungs." Okay. Can't breathe. That's the problem Ecclesia has. If you let your lungs just hang out there, you know, fish comes along and is like, "Hey, that looks tasty." "Ah, leave my lungs alone." Okay. So what happens here is you can do what's called a gill withdrawal reflex. Very stereotypic. You touch the Ecclesia lightly on the siphon tube. It's a little muscular part of the Ecclesia that sucks water in and blows oxygenated water in the ocean across the gill. So it's kind of like how we breathe, in a sense. It's analogous, okay? So it pushes the water across the gill so that the gill can extract the oxygen. If you touch the siphon lightly, this causes the whole siphon and gill to be folded back down inside some protective folds in the body of our sea slug. It does it very quickly. So, but the longer that the Ecclesia has got its gill hidden down inside its body for safety, it's kind of like it's holding its breath. Okay? Because if the gill's not out there in the water, it's not getting oxygen. Right? So, if there's nothing really threatening, if there's nothing really dangerous, you don't want to keep pulling your gill in because you're essentially holding your breath all this time, which means all of your other metabolic functions are going to be shut down, means you're not moving very fast, means you're not going to be able to eat very much, whatever. So if things keep tapping you on the siphon, but nothing bad is happening, habituate. Okay. So working with this is essentially a wire schematic, then, of what's involved in the gill withdrawal reflex of Ecclesia. We've got some sensory receptors on the sensory neurons. Okay, we've got some interneurons. We've got some motor neurons. The sensory neurons innervate with some motor neurons. They also, some of them, bypass and innervate directly to the motor neuron. So we've got a dual branching system here on some of them. Interneurons connect up to motor neurons and so on. So all this does is when sensory neurons detect the stimulus of being touched in the siphon, they activate the inner neurons and the motor neurons. This causes the gill withdrawal muscle to fire. Gill is pulled in. And so this is the system that then habituates. What's happening then is the changes are occurring. So habituation causes synaptic effects. Form of learning, but when we talk about most of the higher learning, classical conditioning, operant conditioning, you know, whatever it is you're doing right now, learning something now, you're probably forming new new synaptic connections. In the case of habituation, we're just modifying pre-existing synaptic connections. There's no new synaptic networks being formed here. What we see happening in habituation is we get a decrease in the excitatory conductance of the neurons involved. The change is all presynaptic. Okay, there's no change to the postsynaptic neuron sensitivity to the neurotransmitters. And basically what's happening, in the short form of this, is we got a reduced amount of neurotransmitters being released, partially because of a reduction in the number of neurotransmitter vesicles in the axon terminals that are being released or freed up to go and try to be released. And we've got a reduction in the number of what are called active zones. The active zones are the actual little places in the axon terminal where neurotransmitter can actually get out. So, schematic of a axon terminal. So here's our axon. Axons tend to end in little bulbs or swellings called axon terminals. Action potential comes down our axon, gets to the axon terminal. This causes a change in the membrane, which allows calcium ions to come in to the axon terminal. The calcium ions, these little purple things surrounded in green here, are neurotransmitter vesicles. Neurotransmitters are actually made down in the soma, the cell body. They're packaged up. That's like the production center. So they're put into the little Ziploc bags, if you will, that are the vesicles, popped onto Axon Transport System. It's kind of like, ever been to airports, larger airports, where there's the flat escalators that you just step on and drag you along conveyor belts? That's essentially what your forward and retrograde axonal transport system is. It just moves stuff from the soma, from the cell body, down to the axon terminal. From the axon terminal, the retrograde is back to the cell body. Anyway, so these things are made down in the cell body, and they get sent down here, and they just kind of, you know, collect in the axon terminal. So they're just kind of floating around there in the terminal. Calcium ions come in. This causes the neurotransmitter vesicles to actually move over to the inner surface of the cell membrane. They fuse with specific points on the cell membrane called the active zones. These are essentially the gates or doorways through which the neurotransmitter can get out. So they fuse up and spew their neurotransmitter out into the synaptic cleft. Some of this just diffuses off and gets lost and is reabsorbed by the body. But if enough of it makes it across to the neuron on the other side, the dendrite, then maybe it'll cross threshold and send an action potential of its own. So that's basically what's happening in terms of stimulating the next neuron in the set there. So that's the release of neurotransmitters. Now, what happens in habituation, I said, is we've got learning occurring without new axons, without new synapses being formed. The chemical changes are all occurring at the synapse. This is then, in a sense, neuroplasticity. There is a change here in the ability of the organism to learn, but it's a temporary change, right? You're not sending new axons off to construct new neural networks. All you're doing is temporarily messing about with the ability of neurotransmitters to get out there and activate the next neuron in sequence. If you release fewer neurotransmitters, you are going to have, or it is less likely that your postsynaptic neuron is going to cross threshold and fire. So, where's my little slide about this? Okay. I thought I had another slide on this. So we'll just explain what's going on here. Two things happen. First, with habituation, the first thing happens is it's harder for the calcium ions to, you know, quote-unquote, entice neurotransmitter vesicles to float over to try to fuse up with the cell membrane. Okay? So fewer neurotransmitter vesicles will actually start to move. Second, it causes a temporary hardening or locking down of some of the active zones. So there's not as many points for the neurotransmitters to try to get out. So a vesicle might move over, try to fuse with an active zone, but that active zone has become temporarily locked down through the habituation process. So it just is like, boom, 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 door's locked. If this room is the axon terminal, and if you are each a neurotransmitter vesicle, and if these are our two active zones, these doors, right? You know, and I say, go! You know, all of you rush out and you head through the two doors. Okay, everyone come back in, you know, restock the axon terminal with neurotransmitter vesicles, and, you know, unbeknownst to you, I lock one of these doors and go, go! You know, half of you run that way, half of you run this way. The ones that run that way, they get out. The other half, you go, you know, up against the door, and you're stuck. All right? By the time some of you go, oh, maybe I should go through that one over there, it's like, okay, we're all done. Only half as many neurotransmitters, you guys, got out. Okay? So that's essentially what's happening with habituation. All right. Now, so that's the underlying neural systems here. More broadly speaking, in terms of behaviors, how do we explain issues of habituation? Well, something that's very popular within, and started becoming popular, well, really fairly early on, from the 1940s, really, in learning behavior, are what are called opponent process theories. So opponent process theories, and there's lots of different types of opponent process theories, but they all share the common elements that they assume there are two opposing components to the system. Okay? And so when we look at the observable behavior is actually the net sum effect of the two underlying processes. Okay, so the behavior we see, there's stuff going on down below. That's not necessarily apparent to us. So we've got these two processes, they do different things, and together we get some outcome. All right. Now, Groves and Thompson, back in 1970, suggested that in terms of the overall behavior of habituation, so we're going to leave the neural stuff behind here. Okay, so moving away from the neural. In terms of are you going to be habituated or are you going to be sensitized in response to something, they said it's a competitive process. They call a habituation process and a sensitization process. Very, very, very crappy use of terms by Groves and Thompson. This completely sucks. When they're talking about their habituation process and their sensitization process, they don't actually mean the behavior of habituation or sensitization. Way to make it confusing, right? Okay, so the net effect, the behavior that we see, either habituation or sensitization, is actually, according to this interpretation, due to the interaction between what they call the habituation process and the sensitization process, which in and of themselves are not the actual observable behavior. So the behavior, whether we are actually habituated or sensitized at the behavioral level, is going to be due to the net sum effect of these two underlying processes. It was just very poor choice that they decided to give the underlying processes the same name as the macro behaviors that we're interested in. Okay, so look at it this way. Graphically, you know, as you see, here, H for habituation process, the H process, and S for the sensitization, the S process, okay? So consider this. Consider our S process to be excitatory, all right? Consider our H process to be inhibitory, all right? So we've been presented with some stimulus. Somehow this activates a certain amount of the S process and a lot more of the H process. You add them together, you just do the straight up math, you know, excitatory units, inhibitory units, and we've got something that's going to be more down on the negative side of things. That's our net effect. In that case here, we'd expect to see habituation, right? Our processes, our behavioral system has been suppressed through habituation. Behavior decreases, okay? If instead there's more enhancement of our sensitization process, the S process here, and less of our habituation process, then our net sum effect is going to be sensitization. Okay? So, our habituation process. Perhaps an easier or a less confusing way to talk about this is they also called, actually it gets more confusing, I suppose, they also called the habituation process their SR system. But at least it's not the habituation process at this point. So your SR system or your habituation process, same sort of thing here. It's the shortest neural path connecting the organs, the sense organs, to your muscles there. In essence, this is your reflex arc. Stimulus, response, okay? So sensory neuron picks up the stimulus, send it to the muscle or the motor neuron, muscular response. There's your reflex arc. Habituation process then, or the SR system, will be activated with each presentation of a listening stimulus. I mean, assuming you cross threshold. Okay, so assuming we've met Sherrington's, you know, requirement for crossing threshold, if this activates your sensory neuron, boom, you get that reflex arc. That's what they describe, the SR, that's their habituation process. Now the sensitization process, they call the state system. So this is the nervous system components that determine the organism's... Oops, sorry, I forgot a possessive case there. Editing. Determine the organism's general level of responsiveness. So if you will, this is the sort of state in which the organism is in at any particular time. Okay? Now, the state system, they argue, is only activated by arousing events. It can also be modified by, say, drugs or various emotional experiences as well. But it's only going to deal with things that are arousing. So here's where we get the sensitization. Here's where we get the enhancement of responding. Yes. So fight or flight, would this be part of what they would call their state system? Yes. That would be something, your stimuli that activate species-specific defense reaction systems, fight or flight, would be activating the state system.
So is that sympathetic and parasympathetic?
They're not really... Yeah. We could probably do that if we wanted, but it's perhaps already... The underlying concept of it being an opponent process system is actually really straightforward. I mean, it's like, well, yeah, okay, right? That's not so bad. Their terminology kind of sucks. So I'm sorry about that. It's not my fault. Blame Graves and Thompson. I think they're still alive. Find them at a conference sometime and say, you guys suck when it comes to naming. Couldn't you have, like, hired an advertising agency or a PR to come up with something a little bit better? Okay. Anyways, here's a few implications that drop out of this. First, the SR system is going to be activated by each stimulus that elicits a response. Okay. Each activation, then, is going to be stimulus-specific. Because it's activating a particular sensory neuron, which then activates the motor. There's a reflex arc. So there's the specificity. So SR activation, then, and any of the resultant habituation that occurs, here, these are going to be universal features of the elicited behavior. Okay. Once you got the system activated, it's going to do its thing. It's going to do it very consistently. The state system is only going to be activated, though, by... particular stimuli that are arousing. They're just arousing stimuli. They're not stimulus-specific in the way that our SR is going to be. Because in this sense here, anything that can enhance the arousal of your system, any sort of stimulus at all, both processes will decay with time. So we get our spontaneous recovery occurring. Bring this in to account for spontaneous recovery here. But look at this as well. We've talked about how habituation is more stimulus-specific than sensitization. Well, if their state system is activated by, I've got only activated by a particular stimuli, but I'm telling you, my extension of this is they're being activated only by arousing stimuli, anything that's arousing, right? Sensitization is going to be much more general. It's going to be much less stimulus-specific, which is what we actually see in the behavior. The SR systems are activated by having particular specific sensory neurons being activated. Then, yeah, it makes sense then that our net behavior of habituation, if we've got that showing up, should be more stimulus-specific, which is, in fact, what we see. Okay. So the dual process, a bit yickety in terms of some of their terminology, but the basic concepts here, you know, in terms of this opponent process system, some issues with respect to the generality of the stimuli, specificity versus generality here, these kind of hold together. So not a bad little theory there. Okay. Just to finish up, we'll look at one last system here. Another opponent process system with respect to habituation. This one goes back to Solomon and Corbett in 74. And they were looking specifically at emotions. Now, emotional reactions, you know, we can talk about them as being biphasic. You can be more excited by something or more depressed by something. And go in different, you know, different directions. Okay. In looking at emotional responses, Solomon and Corbett came to the conclusion that primary emotional reactions, the emotional response actually seems to be generated by the particular event, become weaker with repeated stimulations. So I'm going to guess for those of you that, I'm just picking something, okay? So, you know, for those of you that celebrate Christmas events or pick some other childhood exciting festive holiday event, whatever that might be, if there was some sort of holiday event you did as a child, I'm going to guess you were probably as a child pretty, you know, excited, like pee your pants excited by this kind of stuff. Some people is like, no, okay, fine, whatever. But you could imagine, you know, somebody would be that excited. As an adult, probably not. It's like, hey, it's like, cool, you know, time off school, you know, get some time off work, whatever. Okay, but you're probably not as, if you are, great for keeping the inner child alive, good for you. But it's probably less, yay, for you there. So, habituation looks kind of like an habituation approach, right? So, they suggested that in cases of emotions, we've got a habituation process going on here as well. So we've got a primary emotional response. But they said, you know, another interesting thing you get is after an event is done, something that, after something is finished, you know, causes, something happens, causes an emotional response. Once that is over, they said you get this opposite emotional response. So, Christmas holidays, yay! Oh, they're over. Oh, depression. Back to school. Oh. So, that's this after reaction. What they suggest here is, through observation, the more you've been exposed to this particular stimulus, whatever it is, the weaker the primary emotional reaction becomes, and the stronger the emotional after reaction becomes. There's going to be a change here due to the experience. So, my example, Christmas, okay? As kids, those kids that get to experience some sort of Christmassy thing, very excited, they look forward to it. Yay, great times, woohoo! Sugar rush, the whole bit, you know, presents, turkey, you name it. More presents. Okay, there we go. People come and visit. Fun time. And then it's over. You know, all the gifts are done. You know, the toys are now broken. That's it for the year. And, you know, young kids is like, hmm. But Easter's coming, or whatever it happens to be is coming next. Okay? So the depression, you know, that sort of massive excitement is followed by a certain amount of, oh, it's all done. Are there no more presents? Oh, well, kids get over it quickly. Older you get, you're probably less stunningly excited by it. It's like, I've got to do all the shopping, and I got final exams coming up. Papers still due. I haven't even started it yet. Still, it'll be nice to, you know, get away and see people and whatnot. Yay. Christmas wraps up. It's like, back to term. Got my marks. I didn't do well. I still have that paper to finish. I need more time off. You're probably a bit more down. The older you get, you know, the less it is. Interesting little, you know, factoid here. Incidence of suicides increase post-holidays. Doesn't matter what the holiday is. Doesn't matter what the event is. Regular events, psychiatrists, clinicians, always most busy with patients after the holidays. You'd think maybe the stress leading up to Christmas, having to buy stuff, get everything ready, plan events, you think that would drive people suicidal? Well, some. I mean, there's always some. You know, freak turkey accident or something, you know, whatever. But busiest after it's done, after the holidays are over. Okay? We talk in drug tolerance. We look at drug tolerance in this respect as well. A drug produces a particular emotional effect, euphoria. But the more you take the drug, the less euphoric you are, the less effect the drug has. That primary effect is lessened. And the after effect, the withdrawal, the coming down is worse. You got to keep having more and more of the drug to get the same euphoric effect. Thrill seekers, you know, first time you ever go, you know, I don't know, parachuting, filled with intense, perhaps, fear or excitement or something. Okay, that's great. And after you're done, you're a little let down. It's like, finally grabbed life and lived it to its fullest, and now it's done. I guess I could go again. If you jump a lot, right? It's like, yeah, the jump was okay, but man, I've really got to do something more exciting. I'll jump riding a mountain bike. Okay! Off you go. Do that for a while. Not exciting enough. I'll jump riding a horse. Kind of tough on the horse. Okay, won't do that. Motorcycle. I'll jump only having one parachute. No backup. I'll jump with no parachute whatsoever and carrying this anvil. Well, okay. But to get the same sort of thrill and rush, you got to do something more extreme. So thrill seekers. Yep.
Well, then the initial excitement kind of actually bothered.
Not exactly. It's not exactly acting as a buffer to the subsequent depression. Hold the thought on this, and we'll see how the opponent process system works for this. It's actually quite elegant. Romance, early on in a relationship, it's all, you know, wine and roses and chocolates, and after a while it's like, yep, happy 50th anniversary, yep, I got you new batteries for the TV remote, thanks, yep. Moving on. Okay, so an opponent process theory here for motivation. Salomon Korpis suggests, again, it's a homeostatic. It's sort of a homeostatic theory here. It says, you know, if we get ourselves too far out of balance in terms of our emotions, we're going to be pretty messed up. So extreme ranges of emotional experiences, intense excitement, intense terror, intense happiness, whatever it happens to be, is a stressor on the bodily systems. You go, how can happy be bad? Too much happy? You know, heartbreak up there so much? Pop. Okay? Well, your heart doesn't actually pop. Right? But, you know, too much happy could be potentially a little bad for you there. So they suggest that as a homeostatic process, your bodily systems try to balance your emotional states. They try to maintain an emotional stability. Emotionally arousing stimuli push you out of this homeostatic balance. And with repeated exposure, your body tries to come with ways of coping with this. So essentially, it learns to deal with this perturbations in the emotional levels. So, a little bit better here in terms of the terms. We've got processes. Say, let's postulate that there is a primary, or A, process. This is the quality of emotion associated with the stimulus. And there is an opponent, or B, process. This is elicited by the primary process, but it is of an opposite emotional form. If you remember back to 281, we talked about drug tolerance in terms of Siegel's compensatory conditional responses. Nope. Okay. Well, anyways, similar sort of thing. We've got you get the drug. This produces some effect. So morphine, analgesic. Your body tries to bring itself back down. It counters with an opposing conditional response. Okay, in here, we're not dealing with classical conditioning. We're dealing with a habituation process. So we've got our primary. This is produced by the stimulus. And we get our opponent. And the opponent process, B, is produced essentially by the primary process, or the body's response to the primary. And it is going to be an opposite emotional state to that elicited by the stimulus. So, we could see something like so. This. We talked about our intensity of primary affect or emotion, intensity of affective after reaction. So, Yellow indicates where the stimulus is presented. So you're at baseline. Stimulus onsets. Your intensity of a primary affect starts to go up. This is showing you a curve if you were to observationally record people's emotional state over a period of time, using whatever sort of emotional measuring scale you want, I don't care, you'd find something like this. That's why I'm not giving any names of happy or sad or whatnot here. So the process, you know, your primary affect, your primary emotion, whatever it is, comes up, it peaks, so we get a peak of the primary affective reaction. If it drops down a bit, we get what's called an adaptation phase, maintains a steady level for a while, and then bloop, dips, comes back towards baseline, overshoots, we get the peak of the affective after reaction, so our emotional state that's opposite to whatever this one was, and then we get a decay of the after reaction back to baseline. Okay? Remember our stimulus here, we don't start to get this trip towards the, we don't get this return to, towards baseline and then passing it in the opposite direction until after the stimulus is terminated. All right, now, I forgot to put labels on top of this. This would be early, after only a few, sorry, I meant to put labels up there, I goofed. Okay, so after a few presentations of the stimulus, this is the sort of thing we see. After multiple presentations of the stimulus, look what we got instead. The peak of our primary is much lower. Our steady state level is lower. But our emotional, our after reaction, effective after reaction, much more intense. Much more intense, lasts longer. Okay? So, with, you know, from the first few presentations of the stimulus, or a few events, we get something that looks sort of like this. And again, just using whatever measure of your hedonic, you know, state you want, whatever kind of psychometric measures or behavioral measures you like, however you want to assess it, right, we then get to, after repeated presentations of that same stimulus, we get to something like this. Okay, now. So this is, you know, treat this as actual behavior. Now, opponent process system. So in other words, these curves here are the net sum effect of our underlying A and B processes, our primary A and our opponent B processes. Okay? So these are the net sum effect here of this emotional habituation that's occurring. So this is what we mean by the habituation, right? From the early trials to the later, we get a change in the hedonic response here. Okay. First few stimulations, okay? So opponent process, your A process, the net sum effect, so A my, if B is the opposite of A, it's going to be a negative number. So, you know, plus 10 plus negative 10, we can rewrite that as 10 minus 10. Okay. So A minus B. Okay. So first two stimulations. Here's, you know, our hedonic scale curve. Here's what they propose for the underlying processes. So here's our A process. That's the emotion response generated by the stimulus itself. So, woohoo, up real high, or, oh, very sad, whatever it happens to be, but it increases a lot. It, you know, lines up with our sort of stimulus. Stimulus is presented. Oop, here we go. Yeah, it's there. Stimulus is terminated. Whoosh, drops back down. Okay. B process, the opponent process, activated by the A process. So notice, there's a little lag here. Okay? It's not activated by the stimulus. I haven't got these lining up perfectly, but still. So B process activated by the A process. Initially, first few stimulations, not as strong, but look what happens here. Once the B process kicks in, you know, we've hit our peak. There's our peak of the affective response. Our B process starts to increase. That causes things to drop down. Okay. Our B process now has reached its sort of maximal level for the first few trials. Here we get our steady state. Okay. The stimulus is terminated. So A drops rapidly back down to zero. But we still got the B process going. Remember, the B was initiated by the A. It's not linked to the stimulus itself. So it takes a while now for, now that the A is gone, it takes a while for our B to actually decay. And after a while, the B starts decaying back down to its zero baseline as well. But for a while then, we've only got this opposing force on the table, if you will. We've only got the B here, hence we get this opponent opposite after, the effective after reaction down here. Okay, does that make a certain amount of sense? So we've got our A summed with the B, so down here. These are the underlying processes. We don't see these. Right? These are constructs. We're inferring the existence of these. All right? This is what we actually got. We actually got this behavior up here, and the theory says let's infer based on behavior we've got this. Now, after many stimulations, here's what happens. Our A process, so we get something looking like this. We're not getting as much of an initial response. Steady state, still there, much lower, a much bigger after reaction. A process stays exactly the same. A process is due to the stimulus. Stimulus hasn't changed. It's still Christmas, it's still skydiving, it's still heroin. Whatever it is that you're doing, whatever the stimulus is, that hasn't changed. Hence, the A process doesn't change at all. In terms of this, Christmas really is still as exciting as it was down at the A process. But look what happens. Our B process gets much bigger. Your body gets better at going, whoa, 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 whoa. Let's try to bring this back into homeostasis here. Look, this is much closer through here to the baseline. Hey, nice, huh? You're not being pushed as far away from your baseline. Well, except for over here. Oops. Can't have it all. Okay? So, B process, much larger. You learn to make more of that B process, and it starts sooner. Okay? So there's a little bit of a lag here. I've tried to draw a bit of a lag. Now, your body gets better going, whoa, I recognize this A process thing. Time to get the B process going. Yeah. We're prepared. Here we go. Okay? So, it brings this closer to your baseline, sure, keeps you closer to homeostatic levels there, but once the A shuts down due to the stimulus, you now got to get back to your baseline level in terms of the B. You got to turn your B off, and look, it's a lot larger. So you get more of the opposite reaction. If initially it's happy, 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 then you get more depression. Okay? And that is the opponent process interpretation of emotional habituation. All right, we will see you on Thursday. And I will come up with something to teach you. Oh, there's our goose still going.